This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Vietnam, A New History by Christopher Gosha, narrated by Kirby Hayborn. A note on terms. Words matter. Most problematic of all in this book is the word Vietnam itself. While tribes referring to themselves as Viet emerged in around the 3rd century BCE from present-day southern China to the Red River Valley, at no time before 1802 did these people ever call their kingdoms, dynasties, or states Vietnam. Upon creating a unitary state running from the Red River Basin to the Mekong Delta in 1802, Emperor Xia Long had first wanted to call his new country Nam Viet, or the Viet of the South. Worried that the use of this term implied expansionist designs on China's southern territories, the Chinese emperor reversed the word order to form the term Vietnam, which I render in English simply as Vietnam. In 1804, Xia Long accepted this Chinese-devised coupling as recognizing the independent state he had just created running from north to south. The Chinese continued to refer to it by their old appellation dating from Tang times, An Nam, meaning the settled land of the south. The term Vietnam did not last long under the Nguyen, however. In 1813, the court briefly revived the term Dai Viet, Greater Viet, and in 1838, Xia Long's son, Minh Nang, who ruled after him, changed the kingdom's name to Dai Nam, the Greater South. Subsequent Nguyen rulers used this term until mid-1945. An artificial appellation then, Alexander Woodside writes of the term Vietnam. It was used extensively neither by the Chinese nor by the Vietnamese. The word only took off when nationalists like Tran Trong Kim and Ho Chi Minh used Vietnam as the name for the nation-states they declared independent in 1945. Further complicating the matter is the multitude of Vietnams under study in this narrative. Not only is the use of the term Vietnam for the period prior to 1945 anachronistic, except between 1802 and 1813, but the question also arises as to which Vietnam we mean. From the 17th century onward, two Vietnams existed, one in the Red River Delta based around Hanoi, the other expanding into the Mekong Delta, with its capital in Hue. The same problem arises after 1945, when Ho Chi Minh's Democratic Republic of Vietnam competed with Bao Dai's Associated State of Vietnam and Nho Dinh Diem's Republic of Vietnam. For the sake of clarity, I use the term Red River Vietnam, or Dai Viet, to refer to the Vietnamese polity that first emerged in the north and lasted in one form or another until the late 18th century. For the period between the 17th and 18th centuries, when civil conflicts gave rise to the region fracturing into several polities, I distinguish among them by speaking of Trinh Vietnam, Nguyen Vietnam, and Thế Son Vietnam. These were the three main military houses at odds with each other. This shorthand allows me to maintain clarity without burdening the listener with confusing qualifying statements. For the French colonial period, there was no Vietnam, and I have mainly refrained from using the term, except from the point in time when nationalists began to revive it from the start of the 20th century. For the post-1945 period, I use the term Vietnam to refer to the nation-states run by leaders such as Ho Chi Minh, Bao Dai, and Nho Dinh Diem. However, when referring to these states, I will use the proper terms for each. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam, the Associated State of Vietnam, and the Republic of Vietnam, respectively. I will not use the terms Viet Minh, Les Viets, or Viet Cong to refer to the Vietnamese communists, nor should we resort to the politically charged term Saigon Regime for the Republic of Vietnam. This is not an ideological bias on my part. Rather, these words obscure a complicated but, in the end, fascinating story of contested sovereignties. Finally, Vietnam, whatever its name, shape, or form, has never been an ethnically homogeneous polity. A wide range of ethnic groups, and they did not become ethnic minorities, Ban Toc Tio So, until the emergence of nation-states in the mid-20th century, dominated large parts of present-day Vietnam. These peoples occupy an important place in the history of modern Vietnam and cannot be simply subsumed under the homogenizing nationalist term Vietnamese. For centuries, they were not Vietnamese, and many still do not want to be. Chapter 14 of this book is specifically the story of these non-Viet peoples. When I need to make an ethnic distinction between the two groups, I will use the word Viet instead of Vietnamese, much as one distinguishes the Han, the ethnic Chinese majority in China, from other ethnic groups there, such as the Tibetans or Uyghurs. Again, this is not mere political correctness on my part. Words count, and by using them precisely and carefully, they can help us to shed new light on the complexity of Vietnam in a plural rather than singular or homogenizing sense. That said, I have done my best not to let these semantic concerns muddle the narrative or sidetrack listeners. There will admittedly be times when the words Vietnam or Vietnamese, as well as China and Chinese, appear in my narrative in a general way, because not to have done so would have simply risked losing the listener. Introduction. The many different Vietnams. Most American listeners will remember Vietnam as the decade-long war that bogged down the U.S. Army in a struggle to prevent the Soviet and Chinese communists from marching into Southeast Asia. The Vietnam War ended in a humiliating defeat for the United States in 1975, and, to this day, images of helicopters scrambling to evacuate people from the U.S. Embassy in Saigon to aircraft carriers waiting off the Vietnamese coast remind Americans of that loss. However, the United States was hardly the first great power to send their warships into the waters off Vietnam's coastline. Indeed, if Vietnam is recognizable to so many today, it is largely because this small country is located in one of those coveted parts of the world where the great powers repeatedly collide. Attracted by trade with the Indian Ocean and determined to project its power by sea, the Chinese Empire ruled northern Vietnam for almost 1,000 years, beginning around the 1st century BCE. The Chinese saw in Vietnam a gateway for trading with Southeast Asia and tapping into Indian Ocean markets extending to the Middle East. The Vietnamese regained their independence in the 10th century, but briefly lost it again to the Chinese in the early 15th century, as the Ming Dynasty sent its armadas across the Indian Ocean as far as Africa and the Red Sea. Meanwhile, a new set of imperial powers soon expanded into the region via the Pacific and Indian Oceans. This initially European imperialism assumed a particularly aggressive form in the 19th century, when the French colonized Vietnam and the British confiscated Singapore, Burma, and Malaya. Meanwhile, the Americans crossed the Pacific Ocean to take the Philippines from the Spanish, while the Japanese focused their colonial attention on Korea and Taiwan. Together, these colonial powers also divided up the long Chinese coastline to enclaves, treaty ports, and concessions. The French were perfectly aware of the strategic importance of their Vietnamese colony in this wider imperial competition, perched as it was at the spot where the Indian and Pacific Oceans and the Eurasian continent converge. At the turn of the 20th century, they finished building the deep water port of Cam Ranh Bay, located off the southeastern coast of Vietnam. Russian warships dispatched from the Baltic to stop Japanese colonial expansion into China and Korea gathered there before being defeated by the Japanese at the Battle of Tsushima in 1905. Following the Japanese invasion of China in 1937, President Franklin Roosevelt closely followed Japanese movements down the Chinese coastline and imposed an embargo on Tokyo as Japanese imperial troops started occupying Vietnam in 1940. His fears of a wider Japanese thrust southward were well-founded. In early 1942, having attacked Pearl Harbor and occupied all of Vietnam, the Japanese then concentrated their ships in Cam Ranh Bay before attacking Southeast Asia and striking as far as the Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the Indian Ocean. Created in 1942, the American 7th Fleet helped roll back the Japanese Empire and remained to protect America's post-war control of the Pacific and Indian Oceans. The 7th Fleet first called on Vietnam in 1950 to reassure the French following the Chinese Communist victory of 1949. The Americans went on to station the bulk of their naval forces in Cam Ranh Bay during the Vietnam War, and when they withdrew from the country in April 1975, the Russians took over. Today, geopolitical tensions are again on the rise in the waters off Vietnam's coast. For the first time since the Ming recalled their armada from the Indian Ocean in 1433, the Chinese are actively seeking to expand their naval presence into the Pacific. The United States is in conversation with its former enemies in Vietnam about how best to respond. The Russians have taken a renewed interest in Vietnam and Cam Ranh Bay since the end of the Cold War, and, worried by growing Chinese naval power, the Japanese are also improving their ties with the Vietnamese. Vietnam remains to this day at the center of intense global rivalries, and it is tempting to view the country and its history in terms of the conflicts of the great powers. The problem, however, is that such accounts of Vietnam are driven by the views of those who coveted, occupied, and fought over this country. By casting Vietnam as a former colony or a strategic zone, or reducing it to a single war or a series of wars, the history of Vietnam becomes the story of its relationship with outside powers. There is nothing necessarily wrong with an external take on Vietnam's past. However, such accounts tend to present the history of this country in rather one-dimensional ways. Vietnam was acted upon by the big powers. It was not quite an actor itself. In the great power account, Vietnam is the victim of colonization and domination, never a colonizer or a conqueror itself. Its own internal divisions, ethnic diversity, and conflicts are obscured. Things are changing, however. Thanks to a flood of new research on Vietnam in recent years, the opening of the country to the outside since the 1980s, and the distance now separating us from the heated political debates generated by Western intervention in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, it is now possible to write a new history of Vietnam. This book tries to do just that. It still takes into account the country's position in a coveted part of the world where empires collide, but it also emphasizes Vietnam's own role in shaping its history and highlights the country's extraordinary diversity and complexity. Most importantly, it emphasizes that there has never been one Vietnam, but several remarkably varied ones. During the 17th and 18th centuries, at least two polities existed, one anchored in the Red River Delta around Hanoi, another pushing southward past Hue into the plains of the Mekong. Vietnam only appeared in something of its present S-like form when, in 1802, the emperor of the Nguyen dynasty, Gia Long, following decades of civil strife, united the country. Even then, Vietnam hardly remained inert. Until the 1840s, Nguyen leaders fairly successfully tried to expand their imperial state to include Cambodia and swathes of today's eastern Laos, declaring the Empire of Dai Nam, the Greater South, as they did so. French colonizers had no qualms about invoking earlier Dai Nam imperial pretensions to justify their own colonial expansion up the Mekong River in search of a Chinese El Dorado. However, if the Indochinese Union they announced in 1887 placed Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia within the same colonial structure, the French divided Vietnam territorially into three separate subunits: Cochin China, the South, Annam, the Center, and Tonkin, the North. Between 1862 and 1945, the independent Nguyen state that had unified Vietnamese lands in 1802 was no more. That changed as the Second World War drew to a close in 1945, toppled French Indochina, and nationalists declared the independence of Vietnam and reaffirmed its territorial unity along the lines largely established by Xia Long. Such unity was, however, short-lived. Decolonization, the Cold War, and civil conflicts intersected violently to divide Vietnam into several competing states between 1945 and 1975. In its entire history, Vietnam has only existed in its present national form for about 83 years and some months as of 2016. Never before 1802, for 43 years in the 19th century, 6 months in 1945, and for 40 years since 1976. The great power take on the Vietnamese past tends to overlook this multiplicity. The expansion of Red River Vietnam southward into populous areas also transformed this country into a mosaic of peoples, languages, and cultures. Ethnic Viet, or the Kinh, may constitute the majority of the Vietnamese population today, 85.7% in 1999, but they share the national territory with over 50 other ethnic groups. Centuries before the Kinh, the people of the capital, moved out of the Red River Basin, the Thai, Gerai, Cham, Khmers, and others were the dominant populations in the highlands which hug the Red River lowlands along the central coast and throughout the Mekong Delta. Until the late 15th century, the history of Vietnam below the Red River, even within it, was a very non-Viet one. There was no S-shape to Vietnam. And well into the 20th century, the non-Viet peoples now living within Vietnam's borders outnumbered the Kinh in the highlands, an area comprising over half of the country. It is precisely its multiple territorial forms, ethno-cultural heterogeneity, and diverse colonial experiences, Chinese, French, and Vietnamese, that make the history of Vietnam so fascinating. Specialists inside and outside Vietnam know this, and scholars are increasingly fascinated by the country's diversity. This new general history moves in similar directions. Rather than positing one Vietnam, one homogeneous people, one history, one modernity, or even one colonialism, this book investigates Vietnam's past through its multiple forms and impressive diversity. Let us take a closer examination of what this might mean. Multiple Vietnams. Until recently, Vietnam has commonly been understood to mean today's Socialist Republic of Vietnam, SRV, first declared independent by Ho Chi Minh in September 1945 as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, DRV. The conventional narrative moves rapidly from the French attack on Nguyen Vietnam in 1858 to the emergence of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in 1945 by way of a discussion of French conquest, colonial development, and modernity, and the rise of Vietnamese anti-colonialism, nationalism, and communism. Ho Chi Minh stands out as the main character in this narrative of modern Vietnam, allowing historians to follow him and his Vietnam from Saigon in 1911 to Paris in 1919, and then on to Moscow and Hong Kong, as he embraces communism as the best road to attaining Vietnam's national independence in 1945. This popular account then culminates in the French and American military defeats in Indochina as the DRV marches to final victory over the Republic of Vietnam in 1975. It's the story of one Vietnam. American journalist Francis Fitzgerald's highly influential and Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Fire in the Lake, went furthest in establishing what has become the standard account of modern Vietnam in the English language. Even before the communist victory in 1975, she had proclaimed Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam as the real one. Not only were the Americans supporting the wrong Vietnamese leaders, first Bao Dai, the French-backed leader of the Associated State of Vietnam, then Ngo Dinh Diem, who replaced it with the Republic of Vietnam in 1955, but in so doing, they were also placing themselves on the wrong side of history. Vietnamese history, as defined by Fitzgerald, as being a timeless, deep-seated culture of resistance to foreign invasion and colonial domination, which Ho and his Vietnam incarnated. Like other righteous rulers before him, in Fitzgerald's hands, Ho became the rightful new sovereign, who had emerged in a time of great disorder to seize the mandate of heaven with the support of the people. Published at the height of the anti-war movement, Fire in the Lake sought above all to show how the Americans and their empire, just like the French and theirs, were doomed to failure. Whether one is for or against American intervention in Vietnam, there are serious problems in terms of how American-focused accounts of the wars like this represent the Vietnamese past. By assuming that Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam of 1945 incarnated a timeless traditional Vietnam with its roots deep in an antiquity which was destined to win in the present, Fitzgerald gives us a very essentialized, unchanging Vietnam. This teleological framing of the Vietnamese past prevents us from seeing the multiplicity and complexity of Vietnamese historical experience and the different possibilities for the future that were present at the time. Communist nationalists led by Ho Chi Minh were certainly important, as this book will demonstrate, but communist Vietnam was but one of several possibilities. No history of this country is complete without taking into account competitor states and their leaders, such as French Vietnam, 1858 to 1955, under men like Albert Sarraut, Pierre Pasquier, and Léon Pignon, the Associated State of Vietnam led by Bao Dai, 1949 to 1954, the Republic of Vietnam forged by Ngo Dinh Diem, Nguyen Van Thieu, and others, 1955 to 75, and Highland Vietnams marshaled by Leopold Sabatier, Dieu Van Long, and Y T Iban. These alternative polities undeniably failed, often miserably so, but their stories spanning more than a century deserve our attention if we are to understand today's Vietnam. After all, Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam had to engage with each in order to prevail, starting with Sarraut's in the 1910s. As one astute observer put it in relation to the American Civil War, to exclude all thoughts of the alternative is to lose contact with how it felt to peer into the inscrutable future. In short, it is no longer necessary to write the history of Vietnam as the unique story of the winners. We need to recognize that the history of Vietnam, like any other place in the world, is a series of interlocking forces and people, occurring and acting at specific points in time and space, each generating its own range of possibilities and eliminating others at the same time. So let us try in this book to peer into the Vietnamese past with at least a few thoughts of the alternatives. Modern Vietnams. We might also try to think of modernity in similar terms. Much ink has been spilled over the rather slippery notions of the modern and modernity, to say nothing of postmodernity. For many, modern simply means something recent, not old. For partisans of this periodization, the 19th and 20th centuries usually fit the bill best for delineating modern Vietnam as something recent. For others, modern refers to a specifically Western historical transformation which culminated in Europe and North America in the 19th century with the advent of industrialization, urbanization, secularization, scientific and bureaucratic rationalization, capitalism, and the rise of the nation-state. One can quibble over a precise definition, and there may never be one, but most would agree that these are the main ingredients making the modern. According to this school of thought, Western colonial expansion in the 19th and 20th centuries exported these components to the non-Western world in one form or another. It could be done independently, as in the case of Japan, Thailand, and Turkey, or it could arrive through direct Western colonial connections, as in Vietnam, Burma, or Algeria. Until recently, most histories of modern China began in 1842, with the Chinese defeat at the hands of the British during the First Opium War. Only then, the story goes, did China embark on the road to modernization and progress. As one specialist of China has pointed out, we tend to use the term unmodern to refer to what existed in Europe before 1800 and what existed in the rest of the world until Europeans arrived and changed the way people did things, or, alternatively, until European ideas and opportunities were made available to people in other parts of the world to adopt and adapt to fit their local situations. The history of modern Egypt starts the same way, with Napoleon Bonaparte's invasion in 1798 and the opening of the country to the West. A number of scholars writing on Vietnam and colonial Indochina subscribe to this Western-centric conception of modernity and its accompanying periodization. Pierre Brochot goes so far as to make the French colonial moment the cornerstone of his recent history of modern Vietnam. In their landmark General History of French Indochina, he and co-author Daniel Emery insist on the modernizing nature of the French colonial project. While they certainly recognize colonialism's exploitative character and the importance of pre-colonial Vietnam's achievements, the authors conclude nonetheless that French colonialism introduced modernity in the form of infrastructure, urbanization, science and medicine, capitalist development, bureaucratic rationalization, and the nation-state. Like the 1842 date for those writing on China, or 1798 for Egypt, Brochot and Emery's account begins with the point of Vietnam's colonial contact with the French in 1858. More than anything else, they argue, French colonialism created modern Vietnam from that point in time. They are by no means alone. I myself once attached similar importance to French colonial modernity in the making of Vietnamese nationalism at the expense of exploring pre-existing connections and modernities. That Western colonialism was a major modernizing force in Vietnamese history, few would disagree. I do not. However, the periodization, defining, and framing of all that is modern in Vietnam in such terms comes with real problems. For one, they create a great divide in Vietnamese history between a pre-colonial or a pre-French past and a much more detailed 19th to 20th century Vietnam, during which the country becomes modern. Secondly, by assuming that modern Vietnam began with the French attack of 1858, we lose sight of the complex set of pre-existing historical phenomena and a plurality of lost or multiple modernities that went into the making of a series of new Vietnams. The meritocratic Confucian examination system and the rational, though contested, bureaucracies it nurtured were essential components of modernity present in China, Korea, and Vietnam. Voltaire waxed lyrically over China's laws, institutions, and secularism in the 18th century, contrasting them favorably to the things he so wanted changed in France. Thirdly, far from replacing the pre-existing bureaucracy and its civil servants, French administrators often grafted their colonial state onto it as an effective mechanism of social control, an efficient method of political administration, and a source of information without which the colonial moment would not have lasted for long. French efforts to develop Vietnam's roads, canals, dikes, and the lucrative Asian rice trade also built on pre-existing projects. Ming Nang's reign in the early 19th century deserves perhaps more than a footnote in the history of modern Vietnam. His administrative policies were aimed at territorial integration, state centralization, bureaucratic rationalization, economic development, and ideological homogenization. This is not to say that he achieved all of this, he did not, but rather to suggest that modernity is not an all-or-nothing phenomenon. It exists in multiple forms at different points in time and space, and often blends with and builds upon pre-existing ones. It can disappear as fast as it arrives. It can even coexist with the unmodern. French and Vietnamese women did not obtain the right to vote until 1945. While there is no need to construct an Asian-centered approach to modernity in the place of the Western-centered one, it is useful to keep these wider spatial and temporal considerations in mind in this book, for they allow us to view the Vietnamese past in new ways. This is why I have intentionally left open the precise timing of modernity's birth in Vietnam, rather than insisting that modern Vietnam only emerged from 1858 onward. This makes room for multiple modernities, colonial graphs, and wider connections that the Franco-centric approach misses. It is admittedly a more complicated story, pushing the modern further into the past than most are accustomed, but such an open-ended periodization makes it a much more interesting one. One of the reasons why the brief Chinese colonization of Vietnam in the early 15th century was so important was because it provided the Vietnamese with access to some of the most modern gunpowder weapons of the time, a sophisticated bureaucratic model, and a colonial ideology needed for their own rethinking and building of a new Vietnam long before the French arrived on the scene. Imperial Vietnams. This latter point is important, for by starting in 1858, one would not know that today's Vietnam is the product of its own colonial history, not just the French one. One need only look a little before 1858 to see that the French were not the first colonizers in the Mekong Delta or the Red River Basin. The latter zone, the cradle of Vietnamese civilization, was part of a Chinese empire for a millennium. Once independent of China, the Vietnamese began building and pushing their own empire southward, establishing protectorates over far-flung regions, promoting settlement colonies, alternating between direct and indirect methods of rule over distant multi-ethnic peoples, testing cultural assimilation, and developing their own mission civilisatrice. They were far from finished when the French arrived. And rather than stopping Vietnamese expansion in its tracks, the French often reinforced the Vietnamese imperial project in many places by making them their privileged partners in building another colonial state. The French colonial project in Indochina thus carried within it a second pre-existing Asian one, that of the Vietnamese themselves. These intersecting imperial projects are central to understanding modern Vietnam. Some will object to this focus on pre-French, Asian empires and the making of modern Vietnam. However, such critics forget that colonial connections and empire states were not unique to the West or to the 19th century. They are part of a wider global history made up of empires running from one end of Eurasia to the other since antiquity. Qing colonial expansion into Central Asia, Tibet, for example, in the 18th century, is vital to understanding China today. Indeed, by ignoring the role of pre-existing Asian colonialisms, we fail to pick up on the complexity of countries such as China and Vietnam and the novelty of their territorial forms. This wider view of imperial projects helps to guard against projecting homogenizing notions of ethnicity and national identity back into and onto a much more diverse and, in the end, fascinating past. It also provides a glimpse into state formation as a work in continual progress and sheds light on how power operated in Vietnam across time and space before, after, and often right through 1858. And lastly, like their Chinese, Russian, American, and French counterparts, Vietnamese colonialism generated a complex historical experience marked by violent confrontations with indigenous peoples whom they conquered, as well as peaceful exchanges with them, each of which has had important ramifications to this day. Today's nations are often the historical products of pre-existing multi-ethnic empires. Vietnam, like the United States and the Russian Federation, is the product of several imperial pasts, including its own. Divided Vietnams. The need to go beyond 1858 is important for a final reason of periodization. For if one ventures one last time beyond this conventional date, it becomes rapidly clear that Tsa Long's creation of a unitary Vietnam in 1802 was in fact more the exception than the rule. After breaking with each other violently in 1627, the Trinh and Nguyen military lords came to rule Vietnam as two separate states, but under the nominal unitary rule of the Lê dynasty, until the Thay Son brothers charged out of the central highlands to add a third polity in the late 18th century. That is over a century and a half of a divided Vietnam. There was thus nothing necessarily aberrant about the existence of two Vietnams during the second half of the 20th century, nor was the 20th century the only time during which Vietnamese fought each other. Internecine conflicts racked Vietnam in the 17th and 18th centuries, and long before, some of which expanded into regional conflagrations with the Thais and the Chinese, as they would in the late 20th century. Nor was inter-ethnic violence unheard of as non-Viet peoples, like the Cham, Thai, and the Khmer, resisted Vietnamese conquest or attacked the Viet to expand their own empires. The implications of all this are important to understanding Vietnam to this day. While this book admittedly zooms in on the 19th and 20th centuries, the three pre-1858 chapters provide more than just rapid historical background on the pre-French period. They are an important part of this book's goal of providing a new account of the plurality of Vietnams from the past to the present, one that avoids creating a great divide at the French colonial moment of 1858 between East and West, modern and unmodern, before and after, unified and divided, Viet and non-Viet. Some will object that by exploring Vietnam's colonial, diverse, and divided past, I'm engaging in a postmodernist fetish for deconstructing, or worse, that I will end up legitimating conservative justifications for foreign intervention in Vietnam. I politely disagree. If I take issue with anything in the politics of writing the Vietnamese past, it is a persistent tendency inside and outside Vietnam to exceptionalize it. This is particularly the case in American diplomatic history, where the Vietnam War remains central to critiquing or defending American empire and American exceptionalism. While I have no problems taking American empire and nationalism to task, I do not believe that we have to exceptionalize the Vietnamese and their past to do so. Those who do so run the risk of practicing a form of Western-centered Orientalism that Edward Said warned us against. Balancing all this has been extraordinarily difficult. I have inevitably left out things some would have wanted to see. I certainly could have solved this problem by increasing the size of the book and the level of detail. However, I remain convinced that bigger is not always better. The listener will be the judge of how well I have done. Will specialists of Vietnam find anything of interest for them in this book? I do hope so, for I owe each of them my deepest gratitude. For those specifically wishing to teach and study from this book, I have created a website which includes an online bibliography and material on the historiographical debates about Vietnam, as well as short essays on differences in interpretation among scholars. It is on my homepage at www.cgosha.uqam.ca. Chapter 1. Northern Configurations. In the spring of 1694, Shilian Dashan, a Buddhist abbot in charge of the Changshou Monastery in the southern Chinese port city of Guangzhou, Canton, received two letters from Vietnam, one from a former disciple now serving as the Dai Viet Court's advisor on Buddhist matters, the other penned by the ruling lord himself, Nguyen Phuc Chu. Since assuming power a few years earlier, the Vietnamese ruler had been trying to bring this highly regarded missionary to Hue to help spread the Buddhist church. Part of it was personal. Chu wanted to believe. Part of it was also designed to legitimate royal power and reinforce Nguyen's state-building in a very contested land. To convince the Chinese master of his sincerity, Nguyen Phuc Chu insisted in his missive, "I now devote myself to burning incense and meditation and humbly beg the master of the way to change his mind and agree to travel. Only then will our kingdom prosper." It apparently worked, for a year later, Dashan and his team of over 100 people landed in today's central Vietnam. The Chinese monk immediately set to work, performing the rites making Nguyen Phuc Chu his first Vietnamese disciple, before initiating the royal family, court officials, and various elites into Buddhism. Dashan presided over the establishment of new temples and the renovation of others. He advised court officials and the Nguyen lord on Buddhist doctrine and statecraft, essential to helping the Nguyen make a new Vietnam, independent of the one further north from which it had initially sprung. Dashan could not have sailed back to China in 1696 without realizing that there was not one Dai Viet, but in fact two hiding behind that name, one which had been anchored in the Red River Delta for centuries and still was, the other moving its way southward past Hue. Based in Guangzhou and having proselytized extensively in Asia, Dashan would have also known how overland and seaborne routes had long connected both of these Vietnams to China, the South Seas, and the Indian Ocean. Chinese traders and monks had been crisscrossing these areas for centuries, spreading Buddhism from India to Korea, Japan, and the Red River lands. Confucianism and Taoism had arrived in these countries through similar channels, and as our Chinese Buddhist missionary returned to his monastery, he would have also known that another group of religious men, Christians, were also hard at work in this part of the world where so many people, roots, and ideas intersected. This is where the story of Vietnam's past in this chapter begins, in this open zone running between today's central Vietnam and southern China. Imperial Configurations. A mosaic of 100 Viet. The area of the Red River Delta and the hills that line it from three sides is considered today to be the cradle of Vietnamese civilization, the sacred land from which today's Vietnam traces its national heritage back for thousands of years. Viewed from above, it's a beautiful sight to behold. Emerging from the cragged reliefs of southern China, the Red River slowly winds its way through a rice-terraced delta, then past the capital of Hanoi, before emptying into the Gulf of Tonkin. For thousands of years, the low-lying Red River Basin has been home to diverse peoples arriving via the eastern coast and overland from the surrounding hills. Austroasiatic peoples moving into mainland Southeast Asia by way of southern China are thought to have been among the first to arrive in this area during the Neolithic period, 10,000 to 2,000 BCE. Similar migrations occurred to the west, where three other waterways parallel the Red River's descent into Southeast Asia, the Irrawaddy crossing Burma into the Andaman Sea, the Chao Phraya flowing through Thailand to the Gulf of Thailand, and the Mekong that winds its way slowly from Tibet to Saigon. Some of the earliest settled agricultural communities appeared in the Red River Plains from around 3000 BCE as climatic changes began drying parts of what had until then been a very swampy place. As it did, rice cultivation spread in from northern areas in the Yangtze Valley. Over time, thanks to the development of dikes and canals, inhabitants began to control flooding and used irrigation for double cropping. Such intensive wet rice agriculture supported larger populations, as did early maritime exchanges with Asia. Dominant families emerged, clans united into tribes, and more complex socio-political institutions evolved. The spread of metal and bronze casting technology allowed craftsmen to make agricultural tools, weapons, and a variety of art objects as cloth production flourished. Peoples inhabiting this area participated in a wider civilization covering large swaths of present-day southern China and mainland Southeast Asia. Archaeologists refer to it loosely as the Dongsong culture. Thanks to archaeological excavations, radiocarbon dating, and historical linguistics, we know that this civilization thrived roughly between the 6th century BCE and the 2nd century CE, extending from the Red River Plains to today's northeastern Thailand and northward into southern China's Yunnan province. Its bronze drums, which one can see on display in the National Museum in Hanoi today, were used for religious and political purposes. These drums, some of which boast pictures of elegant cranes, have come to symbolize Dongsun's brilliance and, for many, the origins of Vietnamese national identity. While the Vietnamese village of Dongsung, where many of these artifacts have been unearthed, was an important production site in this prehistoric civilization, the fact that peoples living far beyond present-day northern Vietnam produced similar ones during the same era complicates such nationalist claims. The Dongsung civilization was home to a vibrant collection of peoples and cultures, but it was not always a Pacific region or a unified one. As one group eyed the riches of another, conflicts inevitably arose. Local metal and bronze production meant that weapons were available. Ambitious rulers organized warrior classes to expand their territories and control populations. Local polities rose and fell as small dynasties, tribes, and their strongmen clashed. Indeed, Dongsun drums were often made with war in mind. As far as we know, no one ruler ever gained the military upper hand or projected the charismatic force needed to create a single Dongsun Federation extending from southern China to northern Vietnam. Some scholars have suggested that power was perhaps organized locally around a collection of charismatic military leaders or kings. A local balance of power tended to prevail. Central control would have thus remained diffuse and moved through a multi-centered array of small territories, a patchwork of often overlapping mandalas or circles of kings, who, in turn, often relied upon a spirit world to legitimate their rule. New research, however, suggests that a powerful centralized political authority emerged in the 3rd century BCE in Koh Loa, near Hanoi. A complex of walls, moats, and ramparts supported a surprisingly important urban population for the time. The large amounts of labor needed to build and defend such a center also suggest that Koh Loa achieved a high level of political, social, and economic organization that may have allowed it to dominate other Dongsung locations concentrated in the Red River Valley. The nature of this ancient state formation continued to evolve when the Chinese Qin, 221 to 206 BCE, and especially the Han dynasties, 206 BCE to 220 CE, dominated and then began unifying warring tribes concentrated between the Yellow and Yangtze rivers into a single imperial core state. At the center, between heaven and earth, stood one divine leader, the emperor, equipped with a mandate from heaven. In theory, he ruled the empire through a bureaucratic state and military capable of holding and administering large swaths of multi-ethnic territories. Upon assuming power, Qin and Han emperors soon dispatched their forces southward to conquer new lands. Access to people and resources was essential to perpetuating the imperial state as it expanded from its core area outward. This, in turn, required authorities to devise an array of direct and indirect methods for ruling distant and multi-ethnic lands and peoples. Casting themselves as the leaders of a universal empire, Chinese rulers, imperial officers, colonial administrators, and their explorers viewed the peoples they encountered south of the Yangtze, as well as in the Central Asian steppes, with a combination of curiosity, arrogance, disgust, and fear. Like the Romans, also hard at work building an empire on the other side of Eurasia, the Han coined a range of terms to describe the inhabitants living beyond their empire's confines, people they considered to be bereft of superior Han civilization and thus worthy of conquest. The Romans borrowed the Greek term for barbarian to distinguish themselves from those living outside the civilizing domain of the empire. Han authorities used the terms Yi, Man, and others to make sense of those living outside the civilizing confines of the central country, Zhang Guo. They also used the characters for beyond and across to describe those living below the Yangtze. One such term was Yue, Viet, meaning those from beyond. Chinese officials often coupled it with the word for the south, Nan, to indicate its geographical relationship to the Middle or Central Kingdom, giving us Yue Nan, Vietnam, or Nan Yue, Nam Viet. The Chinese annals confirm, too, that there is never a single Yue Viet state, but rather a collection of dynastic and tribal polities operating across much of southern China into the Red River Basin. Many had fled into this area in 333 BCE when the Qin destroyed an ancient Yue state located along China's Middle Eastern coast. At one point, the Han used the characters Bai Viet or Bach Viet to refer to the 100 Viet tribes located in what they now increasingly viewed as a borderland below the Yangtze River. Enter the Chinese Empire. It was during this shifting geopolitical context, as Chinese rulers began incorporating southern lands into their own Protean imperial formation, that Vietnam enters the Chinese Empire, and with it, the written historical record. Vietnamese writing in the 15th century asserted that in 257 BCE, a local king named An Duong Vong united the Lac Viet and Ao Viet tribes into a single polity in the Red River area called Ao Lac. It consisted of peoples coming from the delta and its surrounding highlands. While it is likely that An Duong Vong took control of the Ko Loa Center located near today's Hanoi, this early state did not last long. Around 170 BCE, it fell to a rogue Han general based in Guangzhou named Zhao Tuo. It included the Ko Loa area of the Red River Delta as well as parts of Guangdong and Guangxi provinces. Zhao Tuo's regime lasted little longer than its Ao Lac predecessor as Han imperial troops moved in. In 111 BCE, the Han dynasty formally incorporated these southern Yi lands, consisting of Viet and non-Viet peoples, into their imperial state as a military commandery. Despite a few brief periods of independence, the people of the Red River remained there until the 10th century as China's frontier province of Jiaoji, Jiaoqi in Vietnamese. Initially, Jiaoji included the Red River Delta and much of today's Guangdong province, the highlands as well as the deltas. In the late 5th century CE, the Chinese reduced the province's borders to today's Upper Vietnam. Control of this southern province was of major concern for the Han. Partly, this stemmed from the attraction of its fertile plains and agricultural production. But trade also pulled imperial strategists southward. The Qin and Han had both extended canal building toward the southern coast in order to profit from international commerce coming from the South Seas and the Indian Ocean, what they often combined into one term as the Southern Seas or Nanhai. The coast of today's northern Vietnam provided an excellent opening for trading with Southeast Asia, the Indian subcontinent, the Middle East, and as far as the Mediterranean. This attraction of the Southern Seas is worth keeping in mind here and for later periods, for just as the overland Silk Road connecting China to the Roman and Parthian empires drew the Chinese Empire deeper into the Central Asian steppes to the north, so too did the Indian Ocean's markets, peoples, and products pull it southward into the Red River toward Southeast Asia. In 231 CE, a Han administrator in Jiaoji was categorical about Vietnam's commercial value, writing to his superiors that agricultural taxes yielded little revenue compared to international trade. This place is famous for precious rarities from afar: pearls, incense, drums, elephant tusks, rhinoceros horns, tortoise shells, coral, lapis lazuli, parrots, kingfishers, peacocks, rare and abundant treasure enough to satisfy all desires. So it is not necessary to depend on what is received from regular taxes in order to profit the central kingdom. The Chinese would in turn export highly sought-after products to international customers, including ceramics, tea, and silk. Like their Roman and Parthian counterparts, Han imperial armies could be massive and conquest was often brutal, despite the lofty civilizing missions proffered by their emperors. Those barbarians who refused to submit to imperial power often paid with their lives. Survivors found themselves jailed, banished, demoted, or homeless. Pragmatic-minded Han authorities realized, however, that such hard-handed methods would get them nowhere in the long run. Blind military conquest and assimilation without a political endgame were costly affairs and only created a sea of hate from which the barbarians would recruit their own armies. Perceptive colonial officials also realized that while the empire circulated Han administrators, officers, and settlers to work in the south, their numbers would never be large enough to operate the state effectively at the lower yet vital levels of the administration in which few spoke Chinese. One Chinese administrator posted to the south bemoaned the gap between colonial theory and practice in a report. Customs are not uniform and languages are mutually unintelligible, so that several interpreters are needed to communicate. If district-level officials are appointed, it is the same as if they were not. Located far from the metropolis, many Han authorities had no choice but to accommodate local leaders by offering them a role in the provincial administration. Rather than defeating aristocratic families, warlords, or shamans, compromises were reached and concessions were made. Outside the provincial capital, colonial authorities used pre-colonial administrative structures, kinship networks, and cults to rule indirectly, regardless of the orders they received from on high, calling for uniformity and assimilation. Over time, the court eventually opened the doors of the imperial army, administration, and academies to Red River Viet as a way of instilling loyalty, building legitimacy, and ruling effectively. While resistance to Chinese imperial expansion was real, so was the desire of many Viet to build a better life from within the empire. This was often the case for groups that had been marginalized under pre-existing orders and saw a chance to reassert themselves and their projects in the new balance of power and within the new imperial formation. Well into the 20th century, elite Viets would serve at the highest levels of the Chinese state and army. Equally important, Han cultural, technological, military, and political modernity proved attractive, especially when it could be used to promote local interests, trade, and identities. As a result, over the centuries, a new Sino-Viet or